for Christ. However, the end of his earthly life marked the fulfillment of only a portion of his mission. The more important part was to be completed after his death, gaining victory as a spirit over the prince of darkness. His crucifixion was only a precondition to that victory. Not, indeed, the crucifixion in itself, but his enduring it without faltering in his loyalty to God. Christ might, indeed, while yet alive upon the cross, have lost faith in God at the last moment, and fallen victim to the enemy. Had he done so, he would have died upon the cross nevertheless, but defeated by Satan and apostate to God. Until that moment, he had stood upon the defensive against the terrific hail of missiles that hell launched upon him. Had he yielded, all would have been lost. The attempt at redemption would have failed, and Christ would have been a prisoner of the prince of darkness. If, on the other hand, Christ as a human being could hold out against the most dreadful anguish of soul and body inflicted on him by the infernal powers, the moment of his death on earth would mark the beginning of the second part of the battle of redemption. He, who as a mortal had stood on the defensive against the powers of hell, now advanced, as a spirit, to attack them to make his victory over them complete. To wage the decisive battle he descended into hell. I want to dwell a little longer, however, on the first stage of this battle, the most important that was ever fought. I want to review with you those hours of Christ's human suffering that you call the Passion. You mortals appreciate far too little the unspeakable agony this divinely sent bearer of the cross had to endure in order that mankind might be saved. On the evening before his death, Jesus was in the guest chamber of a house in the company of his disciples to observe the feast of the Passover. It was to be his last supper with them. Who among you can measure and realize the anguish of his soul? He knew from the divine spirit messengers that all preparations for his arrest and speedy execution had already been made. He knew that one of his disciples had had dealings with the high priests and had, for a traitor's reward of 30 pieces of silver, declared himself ready to deliver his master to them. At that very moment, his betrayer was lying at table with him. They were not seated about a long table, as you. 315. Think, and as they are shown in your paintings, but were reclining upon the skins of animals whose heads were elevated as cushions, gathered in groups of three about small, low tables, one arm resting on the cushions, the other reaching for the foods before them. At the same table with Christ reclined John and Judas, John on his left, his head close to his master's breast, Judas on his other side. Judas dared not meet his master's eye and was anxiously awaiting the moment when he could leave the room without attracting attention. The master's heart bled on seeing before him this apostle who was his betrayer, and whose terrible end he foresaw. It would have been better for him if he had never been born. As he looked at him over and over again, Christ's eyes filled with tears, for his heart was filled with love for even this lost brother. In his mind's eye arose the picture of what within a very few hours was to be reality. Judas, in realization of his monstrous deed and with despair in his soul, standing rope in hand before the tree on which he would end his own life, and beside him Lucifer, ready to take the spirit of him whom he had led astray away with him into the depths. Horrified by this vision, the master trembled. As for the other apostles, would they stand by him in the hour of his martyrdom, offering help and comfort? The fateful events of the coming 12 hours passed like a film before his mind's eye. He could see them all fleeing in terror for their own lives, and Peter, shaking with dread before a maid, swearing he had no connection with his master. He saw the devils crowding about the door of the room, ready to seize upon his disciples as they went out, and to fill their minds on this very night with doubt of their master, in order that they might offer no support or help to the one who was doomed to die. Satan has asked of you, that he might sift you as wheat. Why had Satan demanded this? Only now had God revealed to him what he had at stake in this battle. God's sense of justice did not permit him to conceal any longer from Lucifer the fact that the battle that was now to begin between him and Christ was to decide the sovereignty of hell over the fallen spirits. God revealed to Lucifer that Christ, should he remain steadfast throughout the imminent death agony, would thereafter as a spirit launch an attack upon hell at the head of the heavenly hosts, and that he, the prince of hell, would be overcome and would be deprived of a considerable part of his sovereign rights. At this news, Satan trembled. Then, appealing to the divine justice that had given him absolute sovereignty over the fallen spirits, he demanded that God observe strict neutrality in this decisive battle. What Satan asked was that God withdraw his hand entirely from Jesus, and also leave him no human support, while nevertheless allowing hell to have a free 316 hand. If God acceded to these demands, Lucifer hoped he could by doing his utmost succeed in breaking the spirit of this Jesus of Nazareth at the last moment, and drive him to despair. God granted the terms asked by Satan with the sole exception of reserving to himself the right to strengthen Christ's purely physical vitality. Had he not done so, Christ would have died in the Garden of Gethsemane, and his martyrdom would never have been completed. At Lucifer's wish, all the spiritual and physical anguish of earth, crowded into a few short hours, was to be concentrated upon his antagonist, while at the same time the infernal hosts would be allowed to launch an attack in full strength on him and his followers. For Jesus, alone, betrayed by one of his own disciples, deserted by the others, denied any divine aid against the forces of hell, Lucifer hoped to prepare an end worthy of a Judas. Even as Jesus, after Judas' departure, gave his apostles the bread and the wine symbolic of his approaching death and spoke his parting words to them, his heart was bleeding from a thousand wounds. He was human, as you are, and had no advantage over other mortals during this hour and those that were to follow. On the contrary, he lacked even those things that generally serve to console and fortify human beings in their hours of suffering. Picture him now, going out into the dark of the night to the Garden of Gethsemane. The night is no man's friend, least of all that of someone who is tormented by suffering. His disciples, on whom the evil spirit forces are already at work, walk silently beside him, in dread of what is to come. Under the burden of his soul's torment, he too is silent. At the remote spot in the garden where Christ chooses to offer his prayer for strength, Lucifer is in wait with his ablest assistants, ready to break down their intended victim's spiritual resistance by their united efforts. This is the hour that God has conceded to the Prince of Darkness. Human words are inadequate to portray the terrors of the visions conjured up by hell to its victim in this brief hour. As once the same Lucifer, when he tempted the Son of Man in the wilderness, had shown him the kingdoms of the world in all their splendor in order to cause his fall, so now and to the same end he shows Christ mankind's most dreadful and detestable traits, causing a steady succession of hideous pictures to pass before his eyes, pictures of blaspheming, sinful humanity in its full viciousness and corruption. Then he shows Jesus the supposed fruits of his years of endeavor among the Jews as God's people, pointing mockingly to his disciples, one of them actually approaching at the head of a horde, the 317. Others fast asleep nearby, with never a word of comfort for their master and unable to stay awake a single hour for his sake. And would you die to confirm your gospel for such people as these? Lucifer's mocking voice sounds in his ears, for these humans, who blaspheme your father and will condemn you as a fool if you give your life for such criminals. And have you thought about how you will end? Before the clairvoyant eyes of his trembling victim they now pass the scenes of the suffering in store for him, his capture, the flight of his disciples, Peter's denial, the bloodthirsty roar of the multitude that but a few days earlier had hailed his entry into Jerusalem with hosannas, the death sentence, the flagellation, his captor's brutality, the crown of thorns, the path to Calvary, the crucifixion, everything painted in the most terrifying pictures, in order to drive him to despair and a spiritual breakdown. All the while the spirits of hopelessness and despair were driving the maddest of thoughts into the mind of this victim of theirs, whom all had forsaken. His pulse throbbed, his whole body shook with feverish tremors, his heart threatened to burst, the terror of death seized him, drops of blood oozing from his pores along with the cold sweat and trickling to the ground. All through their master's dreadful experience, his disciples slept peacefully. The meager outlines preserved by your Bible of the story of the Passion of Jesus fail utterly to convey to you the anguish of soul and body suffered by your Redeemer. Indeed, Many of the worst tortures are not even mentioned in the Bible. Thus, nothing whatever is said there of the frightful hours Jesus was compelled to spend in the underground cellars of the courthouse. Into these dungeons, wet and swarming with vermin, the soldiers had thrust him after they had scourged and mocked him and crowned him with thorns, and after they had rubbed salt into the countless deep gashes left by the lash upon his lacerated body and had bound his hands, lest by removing the salt he might find some relief from his unspeakable torments. Never did man endure such torture as did this incarnated Son of God. Through its human tools, hell did its worst, for in him it recognized its greatest foe that could ever appear on earth. But these physical sufferings to which it subjected him were not as great as those that his soul had to endure. Moreover, both forms of torment, of the soul and of the body, were applied to him simultaneously. Add to this the fact that to the last he was without any human comfort, and, what was still harder, without any divine aid. God had withdrawn his protecting hand and had left him helpless to the devices of hell. The cry uttered by Jesus as he hung dying upon the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Reveals in full the agony he felt on. 318. Finding himself forsaken by all in this hour of supreme suffering on earth, Satan should never be able to claim that he failed to reduce this mortal to submission because of help received by his victim from external sources. He should be forced to admit that he had met his match in an unaided human being, who, in spite of the most excruciating torments of spirit and body, could not be driven to desert his God. The biblical account according to which the mother of Jesus stood by the cross, accompanied by John, is incorrect. Even this consolation was denied him. Not one of those dearest to him was at the crucifixion. They could not have borne the sight. Where, indeed, can you find a mother who could look on while her child was being crucified? Again, you go so far as to assume that Mary was standing by the cross throughout. Had she been present at all, she would surely not have remained standing, but would have fainted and collapsed. Hence, it is also not correct that Christ exclaimed to his mother from the cross, Mother, behold your son. And to the disciple John, Son, behold your mother. He did, in fact, speak similar words to Mary and John as he was being led from the courthouse after Pilate had pronounced the death sentence and while his mother and John clung to him in anguish until they were torn away by the soldiers. His mother had been present at the trial, as had the disciples, and had never lost hope that it would end in his favor. She constantly thought of the story of Abraham, whose son was spared from sacrifice at the last instant, even as the knife with which he was to be slain was drawn. To this day there is not a mother who would not attend a trial in which her child's life hung in the balance, but no mother who would go to witness the execution of her own child. To see his mother on the verge of swooning from agony and terror cut Jesus to the soul, and all he thought of was to spare her any further sight of his own suffering. He therefore begged John to take her to his home until everything was over, and spoke lovingly to her, urging her to go with John and to implore God for strength in this hour of tribulation, telling her that it was his heavenly Father's will that he undergo these things and that after 3 days she would see him again. John willingly acceded to his master's request and took Jesus' mother, pierced by a thousand sorrows and keeping to her feet only with the utmost effort, to his home. He did not take her into his home permanently, as might be gathered from the text of your Bible, but for the time being, to remove her from this harrowing scene. One after another all the other faithful followers of Jesus came there too. Some time later, when it was fair. 319. To assume that the crucifixion had been carried out, some of them, including Mary Magdalene, went to a spot from which the site of the execution could be seen, and returned to relate the death of Jesus. Jesus' mother stayed at John's home only so long as she remained in Jerusalem. Afterwards, she returned to Nazareth, her home and that of her other children. Naturally, she often revisited Jerusalem to see the apostles, in particular John, as long as they continued to live there. As Christ had been confirmed as God's emissary by the power of God during his life, so was he in the hour of his death. The sun darkened for 3 hours. It was not a darkness by reason of natural causes, but one affected by the power of God. At the moment when Jesus gave up his spirit, the curtain in the temple was rent from top to bottom, as a symbol that the wall dividing the realm of God from that of Satan had been torn down by Jesus' death. The earth shook and rocks burst. But the story recorded in your version of the Gospel of Matthew that the dead arose from their tombs and were seen by many in Jerusalem is a falsification of the originally accurate text, which read, "The curtain in the temple was rent in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks were rent, and the tombs were opened, and many corpses of those who had passed on were cast forth." Many who had come from the holy city saw the corpses lying there. This text, which is accurate, therefore records what naturally wouldn't did happen, namely that the tombs carved into the rocks were cracked open by the earthquake shocks and that the corpses were cast out upon the surface. There they were, of course, in plain sight of the many who had come from the city to witness the spectacle of the crucifixion and who had to pass close by the shattered tombs. Here you have another of the many instances where, in the past, falsifications were introduced into the sacred texts for specific reasons. The false doctrine that the earthly bodies of humans will be resurrected on some future day had been introduced, and in order to sustain this doctrine with passages from the Bible, this particular passage, in addition to others, was distorted by altering the original text. In place of the words "the corpses of those who had passed away were cast forth" were put the words "the bodies of the saints who had passed away were raised." The word "saints" had to be interpolated if only for the reason that it would never do to say that the bodies of the unsaintly had also been raised at the death of Christ. But a still greater difficulty remained to be overcome in falsifying this passage, inasmuch as the Church holds that there could have been no resurrection of bodies prior to Christ's resurrection. Christ was the first of the dead to arise, hence, it was necessary to insert the sentence, "after his." 320. Resurrection. They entered into the holy city and appeared to many. Those who committed this falsification did not pause to consider that it had already been expressly stated that the bodies were raised on Good Friday, or 3 days before Christ's resurrection. Whether they appeared to the people of Jerusalem on that same day or on Easter Sunday in no way enters into the question. Besides, where did these bodies that allegedly had risen on Good Friday spend the intervening days? Where did they go after Easter Sunday? Did they return to their tombs? And, if not, where did they go? It is strange that the other three evangelists say nothing of this resurrection of bodies on Good Friday. Of course, Matthew did not say anything of the kind either, as you have seen from my explanation. Christ was dead. His earthly death had released his spirit from its material body. As a mortal, he had withstood all the onslaughts of hell and had thereby performed the first and most important part of his messianic mission successfully. He had not been conquered by hell. Nevertheless, this alone did not ensure his victory over the enemy he had repelled, for in a battle between two opponents, he who acts wholly on the defensive is not truly the victor, even if he succeeds in defending himself against the other's attacks. In order to claim a victory, he must overpower his antagonist and force him to acknowledge himself beaten. This was true of Christ as well. As a man, he had repelled all the attacks of his mighty opponent. That was all he could do as a man. Now, however, that he was freed from the flesh, he could, as a spirit, advance upon his enemy, the prince of darkness. He descended into hell, relying upon the all-conquering divine power that he had earned as a mortal through his loyalty to God, who now sent him the heavenly hosts as his comrades in arms. Now began a struggle like that which had occurred when Lucifer with his adherents had battled with the heavenly legions in the days of the great revolt in God's spirit kingdom. The present battle was waged in Lucifer's realm and was a personal duel between Christ and Lucifer, as well as a general battle between the legions of heaven and those of darkness. This mighty conflict raged into the lowest depths of hell, into which Lucifer and his followers had been forced to retreat. Then, when the defeat of the powers of hell was no longer in doubt, many of those who had formerly been their vassals but who, nevertheless, repented of their disloyalty to God, went over to the side of the heavenly hosts and fought with them against their former oppressors. The number of those who thus deserted grew from moment to moment. When Lucifer saw that all was lost, he begged for mercy. He, who in the desert have tried to tempt the Son of God by offering him the kingdoms of 321. The world, now stood quaking before him whose faith in his sonship he had then sought to undermine. Now he trembled at the thought that this same Jesus of Nazareth would deprive him of all his sovereign power, and that the moment had arrived when he and his followers would be doomed to the depths of darkness. He was all too familiar with the prophecy that foretold the time when he, as the prince of the kingdom of the dead, with his henchmen would be hurled into the uttermost depths, shorn of all his power and deprived of his sovereignty over God's fallen children. Christ, however, disclosed to him that he was not to be deprived of his sovereignty entirely, but that it was to be restricted to those of his subjects who were wholeheartedly devoted to him, and that all who desired to leave his kingdom and return to God must be released. He was no longer permitted to regard them as his subjects. He might, if so disposed, bind them to himself by artifice and guile, but not by force as heretofore. Satan accepted these terms. He had no other choice. He had, in fact, expected much harder conditions. The title by which he held his sovereignty and which God himself had once issued to him was changed to suit the wishes of his conqueror, Christ. God, in whose name the victor made terms with Lucifer, is the just and almighty protector who guarantees the precise observance of this peace treaty. Everything, even hell, is subject to his power. His commands must be obeyed even by those who are his enemies. Thus was concluded the mighty task of redemption. God's plan of salvation had been realized in all of its important aspects. The chasm that gapes between the realm of darkness and the kingdom of God had been spanned by a bridge that could be crossed freely by all who desired to leave Satan's foreign legion and to return to their old home in the land of God. No sentinel in the service of hell could prevent them from crossing the border. Surrounded by his triumphant hosts, Christ returned from Satan's stronghold to the sphere that once had been paradise, and the cherubim who had since stood guard at its entrance lowered their flaming swords in a salute to Christ, their King and Lord, and his victorious spirit legions. Here in paradise they stayed until the day on which, with Christ at its head, the great procession re-entered the portals of heaven. During this time, however, neither Christ nor his hosts of spirits were idle. Their stay in paradise had to be utilized to spread throughout all creation the news of the Redeemer's triumph and to urge all who were of a mind thereto to begin their homeward journey. Special pains were taken to seek out the countless sufferers in the lower spirit spheres in order that they might be instructed, encouraged and comforted, and urged to rouse. 322. Themselves and to set out upon the road to the Father's house, which Christ had laid open. Christ himself directed the counseling of these countless brethren and saw to it that as many as possible set out on the homeward path without delay. This is indicated by Peter in his epistle, as a spirit Christ went and brought the news to the spirits in prison, to those who had once been disobedient, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah, while the ark was being built. I Peter 3, 19-20. Christ appeared, materialized in a human form, to those who had been closest to him in life and had borne much sorrow with him and on his behalf, his mother, the apostles and his friends. The day arrived on which Christ returned to the spirit hosts that were waiting for him in paradise, after he had said farewell to his friends on earth and had assigned to each his task. This was the day of his ascension, on which, as a conquering hero, he led a great spirit army back into the kingdom of God. Ever since the redemption was achieved by Christ, those who have fallen away from God have been free to make use of the redeeming opportunity thus offered to them. Satan's prisons have been thrown open by Christ's victory, and his captives have been free to return to their homeland. Whether or not they avail themselves of the opportunity rests with them. Christ has indeed built the bridge, but whether it is used to return home is left up to each individual, who may not shirk the hardships attendant upon the journey. Consider what hardships the prisoners taken in the World War I, were ready to undergo after peace had released them from their captivity, wandering from the farthest steppes of Siberia with bleeding feet, week after week, in their efforts to make their way back to their homelands. The prisoners of Satan must do likewise if they would find their way back to God's homeland. Christ will help them through His spirit world to overcome the hardships they will face in their wanderings. His messengers show them the way, strengthen, encourage and comfort the travelers, and raise to their feet those who have stumbled and fallen from exhaustion. But the homeward bound travelers must not turn back and re-enter the ranks of the enemy by deserting God. If they do, it will take all the longer before they again come to the resolution, "I will arise and go to my Father," but everyone, without exception, will see the day on which he can no longer appease his hunger for peace and happiness at the troughs of evil, and he will finally set out on the homeward path. 323. For some, the span of a single human life will be sufficient. Others must suffer for hundreds, and still others, for thousands of years, far away from God in their search for the gold of happiness, which they seek in the counterfeiters' dens in the realm of darkness, led by Satan's minions from one will-o'-the-wisp into another. It is their own fault that they must pass through repeated human incarnations, and that they are so slow to find the road of light that their loving Father and His Son, the great Redeemer of the fallen, have built for them. 324. Christ's teachings and today's Christianity. See to it that no one captivates you by means of so-called science or by the foolish and misleading teachings grounded on the traditions of men, for they have their source in the evil spirit powers that rule the world, but have nothing in common with the teachings of Christ. Colossians 2:8. During the first spiritistic seance I attended, I had asked the spirit that was speaking through the medium, "Why is it that the teachings of Christ no longer seem to exert any influence upon the people of today?" I had been told in reply that we no longer possess Christ's teachings in their original purity and clarity, that in the course of time, many human errors had crept into Christianity. Later on, I received a detailed exposition, in which the true teachings of Christ were compared with the doctrines of the Christian churches of today, and particularly with those of the Catholic faith, of which I was a priest. I was told, "Where is the water of a brook purest and clearest, near the source or near the mouth?" Most assuredly, near the source. As the spring water flows on as a streamlet, however, it loses its freshness and with it its purity and clearness. Muddy waters coming into it right and left mingle with its current. Further down it receives the drainage from human habitations, human and animal waste, and that of human industry. It no longer refreshes those who would drink its waters to quench their thirst. They drink of it only with revulsion and only as a last resort, when no spring water is to be had. The same may be said of the truth. Taken at its source, it is a refreshing drink that bestows new life, but when it is drawn from the stream that has flowed for a distance through the lowlands of human error and worldly passions, its purity and freshness are gone. The falsehoods and errors that have been mixed in have given it a bad taste. The thirsty truth seeker drinks from this murky stream only with inner repugnance, and only when denied the clear water of the fountainhead of truth. The teachings of Christ met with a fate like that of the water from a spring that, as a brook, flows by the dwellings of men. They, too, were defiled when they flowed through human channels. The evil that is in men and the powers of evil that surround them have so sullied and rendered unpalatable Christ's pure teachings, that they have lost their life-giving power. 325. The source of all truth is God, a source to which man cannot ascend in his earthly form. He must therefore depend upon the bearers of the truth who draw from that source. These are God's spirit messengers, and only they are admitted to that source. Only they possess the clean vessels in which the truth can be brought fresh and unsullied to mankind. The first and the greatest of truth bearers was Christ as a spirit, in the days preceding his incarnation. It was he who, partly personally, partly through his subordinates in the spirit world, brought the drink of truth to early humanity. Hence the active intercourse with spirits by the sick and exhausted world of Old Testament times. Hence, also, the coming and going, in the early days of the Christian era, of truth-bearing spirits, who constantly drew upon God's fountainhead and brought the water of truth, at Christ's behest, to the human souls who thirsted for the truth. It is, therefore, One of the fundamental teachings of the true Christian faith that humans cannot proclaim the truth out of their own consciousness. They can do so only as instruments of God's spirit world. Even Christ as a mortal could not ascend of his own volition to the source of the truth.